Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has a big moment in the sun right now. For years, as Washington stood frozen in angry opposition to Iran's theocracy, the mullahs in Tehran have seriously outplayed the U.S. on the nuclear front, dodging, feinting, blustering, and moving steadily ahead toward nuclear weapons. Last week, Condoleezza Rice convinced the White House to finally drop 27 years of refusing to talk to Iran and offer negotiations. With that, she outflanked Washington hardliners, stole a beat on Tehran, and for the moment, won a united global front. But now what? Up next, On Point, the hottest chess game in the world, Iran, nukes, and what comes next. Here's Secretary Rice yesterday on Fox News saying it's time to give the Iranians a little time.
We understand that it may take a little time for Iran to assess the situation. In short time, they will be presented with the actual proposals that the EU3 and others have been considering, and I think we have to give that some time.
No pressure, she says, but then again, we can't wait forever.
I'm not one for timelines and specific schedules, but I think it's fair to say that we really do have to have this settled over a matter of weeks, not months.
The stakes are huge. It's a giant chess game. Joining me now from Washington is Andrea Mitchell, chief diplomatic correspondent for NBC News. She traveled with Secretary of State Rice to Vienna last week, where the so-called Vienna Agreement was struck. Andrea, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Could Colin Powell have done this, and how did Condoleezza Rice pull it off?
Well, in fact, it's ironic because it is Colin Powell's strategy. It's the policy that he advocated in his deputy, Richard Haass, who is now at the Council on Foreign Relations. And, in fact, their frustration over Iran policy was one of the reasons why Haass left, certainly, and why Powell felt increasingly marginalized.
But the White House never did it under Powell, and now exactly. President Bush has signed off with Condoleezza Rice. Is it because the U.S. is in a better position, a weaker position, because of their personal relationship? What?
It's partly because of their personal relationship, but partly because the U.S. is in a far weaker position. And you could argue that had they done this years ago, before the president 4 years ago declared Iran a member of the Axis of Evil, allegedly rogue nations, that in fact with a more moderate government in Iran and at least a fledgling democracy reform student movement, which was later crushed, with oil at $19 a barrel rather than 72 or whatever it is today, dollars a barrel, that they would have had a much better opportunity to try to negotiate with Iran.
Andrea, remind us of who has signed off on this. The United States is now standing shoulder, kind of to shoulder, with whom in offering these carrots and sticks?
The entire European Union, Great Britain, and most significantly Russia and China are united. The permanent five members of the Security Council are united behind this, plus Germany. And the interesting thing is that Russia has now come along. Now, whether or not Russia will still be there and China, if Iran refuses and if it then goes back to the Security Council and if they then begin discussing punishments is another question. Significantly, when we were waiting outside while they were negotiating for hours and hours on Thursday night, and they had called us over because they thought they would have an announcement around 8 o'clock Vienna time, and instead, close to 10 o'clock, they finally came out 2 hours later. The big argument was over how to soften the language so that it would not be very specific at all and would not use the word sanctions. So they went all around to try to say there would be steps or measures. The big problem was how to describe the sticks, not the carrots. And they eventually decided to not use that S word, sanctions, because that would signal Iran, in the Russians' view, that this was more American propaganda, according to the Russian foreign minister. They had to somehow show Iran that this was a serious measure. And interestingly, it hasn't leaked. The specifics of it have, we all sort of know what's in it, in the carrots, but those measures have not leaked because the Russians again persuaded the Americans and the rest that if they kept it secret until it was presented tomorrow to the Iranians by the Europeans, that the Iranians would take it more seriously.
Javier Solana headed to Tehran to lay it out. The Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad saying on Saturday he's going to lay out all the details. What is known about the carrots, the incentives, and the sticks? Privately, it's not being put out in public, but what's the shape of it?
The shape of it is that Iran would be able to get civilian nuclear reactors. This is after years and years of the United States having as a principle of faith that Iran should not be permitted to have civilian nuclear power because they could use it to hide a weapons program underneath the cover of a civilian program. But now the United States is on board with that. They would be allowed to have civilian nuclear power, which they are already developing with Russian help. They would get airplane parts, Boeing and other American-made parts. So sanctions, economic sanctions on Iran that have been unilaterally imposed by the United States and several other countries would, in fact, be lifted. Iran would get membership into the World Trade Organization. The bet here is that, unlike North Korea, Iran does not want to be isolated. Iran wants to be part of the wider world, and in fact, as a top State Department official said on the flight back from Vienna to the United States, we're the outliers here. This is quite an acknowledgement. We're the ones who are isolated in the world because we're the only ones not dealing and trading with Iran.
That is, we, the United States, in the case. And the sticks, what's known about what is or might be threatened as part of this package?
Well, more economic sanctions, restrictions on trade, restrictions on World Trade Organization membership, and banking restrictions so that currency, visas, and other kinds of ability to move freely around Europe and the rest of the world would be tightened considerably.
And the Security Council level sort of measures, military measures, is that anywhere in this mix?
No, they're not. In fact, the U.S. gave that up clearly at the outset. And in fact, it now appears that if it were to go back to the Security Council, there would be no talk of sanctions in the initial round. There would be a resolution first and then a second resolution before any kind of economic tightening would be imposed. So the U.S. gave up quite a bit of leverage, but partly because it doesn't have a great deal of leverage at the Security Council. On May 8th, Condi Rice and all the rest of us were in New York for a Security Council showdown, and it was very clear then that this was not working, and it was then that she went back to the president and said, we really have to find another course.
She had a losing hand. They changed course last week. We will see what unfolds now, but what a game. Andrea Mitchell, who was with Condoleezza Rice in Europe, flew back, got the lowdown here. We're grateful to you for being with us today, Andrea.
My pleasure.
Andrea Mitchell, chief diplomatic correspondent for NBC News. Joining me now from New York is Vali Nasser. He is adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, author of Democracy in Iran. Vali Nasser, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Michael McFaul, senior fellow and co-director of the project on Iran at the Hoover Institution, co-authored After the Collapse of Communism. Michael McFaul, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Vali Nasser, first to you. Are we in a new world after this offer from last week, or is this more dancing?
Well, the answer is yes and no. In some ways, as Andrea Mitchell said, this is similar to what Secretary Powell initiated. However, the major difference is the signals that Secretary Rice has said, and yesterday she said it on Fox News as well, that the United States now is not so much concerned about the character of the regime, but about regime behavior. And this approach is obviously something very new. But whether or not it actually becomes U.S. policy greatly depends on what response Iran gives to these proposals.
Not the character, but behavior. Michael McFaul, does that mean that regime change, which has long been an American policy here, is dead, or is it just put on the to the side for a moment? How do you see it?
Well, I think different people in the Bush administration would answer that question differently. Condi, of course, Secretary Rice has said that she wants to talk about behavior now and not the regime. That does signal a rather dramatic change for her personally in the way that she has talked about Iran. Let's remember just a few months ago, she testified before Congress and announced a $75 million proposed budget to help democratization in Iran. She's not talking about that today.
And when they say democratization, they mean regime change, essentially.
Yes. I mean, I personally...
New folks in power.
Yes. Regime change is a terrible word. It's a political science word that we used to use in a very boring way 10 years ago, but George W. Bush has changed that all.
Doesn't feel boring anymore. It feels like war jets in flight.
Right. Although, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the division in the Bush administration is between those that support democratization and those that are more concerned about the nuclear weapons program. And those that the real hawks, if you will, on Iran are not regime changers, because the best way to consolidate the mullah, the regime in Tehran, is to bomb Tehran and Isfahan and other places. That would be the best way to consolidate the regime. So ironically, the debate within the administration is much more complex than just hawks and moderates today.
Vali Nasser, how do you see it? Do you see a snowball's chance that Tehran is going to stand up and say, A, yes, we'll talk about it with the United States and the others, and B, yes, we will surrender our nuclear weapons program, period?
No, I don't think it's going to be as easy. I think, first of all, the Iranians don't like the precondition that has been put on the table. In fact, a number of particularly conservative newspapers in Iran have been writing that essentially the United States asking that the Iranians give up what was supposed to be the object of the negotiations. In other words, if they give up on enrichment ahead of the time, what is there to negotiate about? Secondly, I think the Iranians, in ways that Mike was already articulating, that so long as they assume that at least a segment of the Bush administration was intent on overthrowing them, that there was no point in really engaging on the nuclear issue. In fact, they thought that the nuclear debate was not really about nuclear issue, it was about regime change.
We're joined right now from Berlin by Constance Stelzenmüller, director of the Berlin office of the German Marshall Fund of the United States and former international security and defense editor for Die Zeit, the German newspaper. Constance, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The Europeans essentially had zero luck negotiating with Iran. Will it be different now? Why?
Well, Europeans have been very successful in positing to the American government, and I think Angela Merkel, Germany's new chancellor,
yes,
at the end of last year, was in the forefront of that, saying that if we are divided over Iran, we will be unsuccessful in any kind of diplomacy. And in that sense, the Europeans always knew that they had to have the Americans behind them. They've now succeeded in doing this, and it appears that Angela Merkel's excellent relationship with America's president has a lot to do with this.
But the United States was at least rhetorically supporting Europe's efforts to negotiate this nuclear threat away. What difference does it make if the U.S. is at the table?
Well, that means that the Iranians, that Tehran sees that there is no light between America and Europe. That was always a very important point. It also means Tehran must read this as Europeans having given something to America as well. It's very obvious that if this line of diplomacy does not work, the Europeans sometime down the road will have to agree to American notions of sanctions.
So are you optimistic or pessimistic about ending what appears to be quite a real threat of nuclear weapons being developed here?
That's a very difficult question, because it's so difficult to read the mind of the Iranian regime. As Michael McFaul pointed out, it's much more complicated than just hawks versus moderates. If the Iranians act in their enlightened self-interest, they would agree to this. It would be certainly in the best interests of the world, because it would make obvious to the Muslim world that it is possible for a Muslim country, even if Iran is a non-Arab country, for a Muslim country to work together with the West on issues as complex as these.
Michael McFaul, how about it? Do you see this government as stepping up and really honestly negotiating here, or is that an illusion? We're already hearing that there are no small number in Washington who say this is fine to offer it. It's never going to happen, so we'll just come back to where we were, but with a stronger international solidarity in confronting Iran.
Well, first of all, I do applaud Secretary Rice for taking this step. I mean, as you pointed out in your introduction, you know, 27 years of doing nothing. At least this is
a long time.
A step, yes. But to play on your analogy of a chess game that you started with as well, I mean, this is a move, it's one move on the board with a pawn. We're not playing with rooks and queens here. And I think it's really important to understand that.
George Bush is a rook?
Well, I mean, think
pawn?
Of what... Well, just remember what Condi asked the Iranians to do, and Vali's point is very important here. She said, suspend your enrichment program before we talk.
Yeah, suspend, not end, but suspend. So take a pause while we talk.
Yes, and if you listen then to what Andrea Mitchell said mm-hmm. were the carrots, these are all things that have been put on the table before. I mean, we're way past the idea that we're going to stop Iran from having nuclear reactors. Bushehr, the Russian reactor that has been built by the Russians, is ready to go. We haven't been arguing about that for years. Airplane parts, this has already been mentioned before, and Iran in WTO, this has already been mentioned. So from the Iranian perspective, and looking at the press accounts of this, it's mm-hmm. very clear they're saying, well, what really is being on offer in terms of the carrots? On the flip side, if you think about the sticks, and it's all secret and we're not going to know them until Mr. Ahmadinejad publishes them tomorrow for us all,
maybe. Yeah.
They're not serious. If they can't even use the word sanctions, let alone actually try to implement them, I think the Iranian perspective will be, well, look at this and play it out and see what else they put on the table until they really, truly have to get serious. So I'm not optimistic that this is going to lead to a kind of negotiated solution.
Constance, your perspective then from Berlin. Europe's been hip deep in this for a while now. As Michael McFaul describes it there, it's a kind of smoke and mirrors, almost a joke.
I think the Europeans have been very seriously discussing sanctions. And obviously what you would want would be intelligent sanctions. In other words, sanctions that hit at certain elements of the regime and not at the larger population. And my sense of conversations here is that Europeans are willing to go that road. The question is, would Beijing and Moscow be willing to go along? And as we all know, even intelligence sanctions are worth relatively little if the P5, the permanent members of the Security Council, are not united on this.
Do you see Russia and China, do you see any way they'll line up with sanctions?
I have my doubts.
Why?
It would be very difficult to persuade them because they have perhaps a greater interest in trading with Iran, because they might also have an interest in seeing a Western alliance of the United States and Europe weakened on this. We don't know that yet, and I don't want to be a gloom monger, but that is a possibility down the road.
I want to turn to our listeners. A lot of them want to join us. Alan's calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan, you're on the air.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of this is just for domestic consumption to make them look like diplomats for a change, because it is. It's a non-starter. This is something they knew was going to be rejected. And we have to remember, first, there's two things we have to remember. First of all, they've already sent those bunker busters to Israel, and I believe they're nuclear. And the second thing is...
You're talking about weapons that might be able to hit underground nuclear labs in Iran.
Right.
Okay.
But the second thing that I think is much more important is the Iranians, what is their objective? They want to be at least consulted as a regional power. The U.S. wants none of this. They want to make sure that Iran is crushed and that we have Israel only as the regional power. I've seen a lot of information on that. And that's really what we have to think about, is that's their real objective.
Alan, let us pick it up. Vali Nasser, how about ultimate objectives here? Is this a showdown between the U.S. and Iran for dominance in the Middle East? Is that an accurate way of describing it? And do you see any chance that Iran might come around? Might they, in fact, talk about it in-house and say, you know what, we're better off taking all these carrots and going to the bank with him right now?
I don't think so. I don't think Iran sees it as a competition with the United States over regional control, but definitely I think some elements in the U.S. see it that way. I think
how does Iran see it then, if not that contest?
Well, Iran sees that itself as a regional power. It sees itself as having legitimate in its minds economic, cultural, political and security interests, and it wants those to be recognized in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Persian Gulf, in Central Asia.
Doesn't that put it right in America's face? I mean, our troops are in Iraq and Afghanistan, as you mentioned, not to mention Central
Yes,
Asia.
It does. But I think the issue is a little bit bigger. It's the mm-hmm. issue that Mike also alluded to earlier, is that for Iran, the key issue is whether or not this is just a tactical move by the U.S. to placate the Europeans, much like Secretary Powell going to the United Nations, and that the U.S.'s intentions in terms of containing Iran has not really changed. I don't think the Iranians will really negotiate honestly unless they believe that the negotiation is the path forward to changing the context of U.S.-Iran relations. And I think the key for them is not the carrots and sticks that are there, is whether or not the U.S. is willing to consider a different red line than it's currently put on the ground, which is zero enrichment in Iran ultimately.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If the U.S. is not willing to change that, and many Iranians have mentioned it, if it's not willing to even accept 100 centrifuges in Iran,
mm-hmm.
then essentially it means that it's still determined to do what it wanted to do, whether it's regime change, whether it's containing Iran. And in that context, there is no incentive really with it for Iran to negotiate because the Iranians feel that they have a fairly strong hand. Both because of China and Russia, but also because the U.S. is militarily stretched. Even a military attack on Iran cannot necessarily have the desired effect because it's very difficult to follow it with a land war with Iran at this time.
Mm-hmm. Constance, what about the Berlin perspective here? Our caller says this feels like the run-up to the Iraq War. What about in Europe? Do Europeans, are they suspicious of the United States that they may be once again herded toward a situation where the only options seem potentially even military?
No, I disagree with the caller completely. One, I think they're, to me, what he said sounds like conspiracy theory. The fact of the matter is that both the United States and, as is sometimes suggested, Israel, neither of those have military options that are in any way realistic in with regards to Iran. And even if they attempted a military strike, the political cost of that to any other diplomacy or other operations that the United States, in fact NATO, has in the region would be prohibitive. It would be disastrous. And Europeans are very well aware of that. They're also well aware, and I believe this applies to policymakers as much as the general public, that this is a genuine shift in American diplomacy, that Condoleezza Rice and her diplomats and the White House have been very flexible on this, have listened to European diplomats, including and particularly Angela Merkel, and people recognize that, and they see it as a welcome sign of change and flexibility.
New time, new tone. Whether it works, we'll see. Constance Stelzenmüller in Berlin, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Let me get a call from Saeed in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Saeed, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Yep. I wanted to talk about one aspect of the carrots that is being talked about, and that is the question of security guarantee.
That is, would the United States guarantee Iran that it would not offend its security?
Exactly, but that means something entirely differently to the Western negotiators as it does to the Iranian Ayatollahs.
What do you mean?
In the minds, when in the West they talk about security guarantee, they're talking about guarantees that the United States or no other foreign country would attack Iran externally. In the minds of the Iranian security guarantee, in the minds of the Iranian Ayatollahs, when they talk about a security guarantee, they're talking about security against their own people, against the groundswell of revolution that is building in Iran that is going to swallow the Ayatollahs in the next period of time.
You mean the theocratic government wants a guarantee that the United States will not ally with the Iranian people against it? In other words, a guarantee against regime changes as well as sort of old-fashioned intervention.
Exactly. That is the Achilles heel of this government, and they understand it far better than people in the West appreciate. When President Bush told the Iranian people that as you stand for your freedoms, we will stand with you. That is the Achilles heel of this regime, and the Ayatollahs in Iran are looking for that sort.
Saeed, let us look at that, and we thank you for your call, Michael McFaul. How about it? When Iran's President Ahmadinejad spoke on Saturday, he made that speech at the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini, of course, the founder of Iran's theocratic state. So symbolically and physically, he was standing right next to the original Ayatollah. Is it internal uprising that Iran's current leaders most fear, or is it something from outside?
Well, all autocrats all the time fear their people. I think that's a statement of comparative politics fact. To what extent this particular regime at this time is fearful, I don't know. I suspect they're not. It's much more consolidated today than they were just a decade ago, and everybody should go out and buy Vali's book, which explains why that is the case. Mm-hmm. Vali Nasser, my colleague here. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I think Saeed raises a very important point, at least for me. That is, when we talk about carrots and sticks and, you know, little moves versus big moves, my own view is that we should be much bolder and what we put on the table in terms of a negotiation. I find it rather ironic that the first time in 27 years that we're going to sit down with the Iranians, we're going to talk about, you know, enriching fuel for either a nuclear power plant or a nuclear weapon.
So how would you kick it up? What would the big
game
like be?
To see, I would like to see, you know, talk about state sponsorship of terrorism on the table. I would like to see talk about democracy and human rights. Ramin Jahanbegloo, a philosopher, a colleague of mine, is in jail. I would like to see why he's in jail on the table. And on our side, I would like to see the discussion of full diplomatic relations on the table as well. Now some people say, well, why is that? That would just be giving away everything. But here, I think what Saeed said is very important. If you want to ally with the people and have interaction with the people, the best way to facilitate that is to have Americans in Tehran.
They haven't been ever since that long captivity. We get our communications as recently with Ahmadinejad's letter through the Swiss.
Well, that's right. And now it's a gamble. And who's to say, you know, maybe diplomatic relations would strengthen the regime, as some people say. But my point of view would be at least it would fundamentally change the dynamic. And most importantly, I think laying out a grand agenda to discuss would actually begin to exacerbate the divisions within the regime. This current gambit hasn't done that. Everybody agrees, the softliners and the hardliners, that they want to have the right to enrich uranium, right? But if you put this on the table, I'm sure that Mr. Ahmadinejad is going to say, hey, wait a minute. We don't want the great Satan in here with their minions and their office and AID and the Peace Corps and all that stuff. Whereas other more moderate people in the regime who are not so interested in revolution anymore and are really just interested in protecting their property rights, they might see this as a way to, protect themselves from the hardliners like Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Valeh Nasser, is that the path to defusing the nuclear threat, pump it up to the big ideological context, talk with Iran about democracy, human rights, offer full relations, or is that a way to sink it all for sure?
Well, ironically, I think actually Iranians would be more interested in that discussion because even going back to Saeed's question, is that whenever we talk to them about a very narrow thing, and we forget we have talked to them and sometimes successfully, for instance, the United States and Iran negotiated very successfully over Afghanistan, even though it was never publicly
kind
acknowledged.
Behind the scenes over the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iran's tacit and sometimes more than tacit support of that.
Absolutely. And there were actually intense negotiations on the sidelines of the Bonn Conference, which put Afghanistan back together between high-level Iranian officials and Ambassador Khalilzad at that time. And it was successful. But because it was always limited to something very narrow, it never went anywhere. And in fact, the Iranians came away from those negotiations believing that you could always have an agreement with the U.S. over something much more specific, and then you're back to where you were again.
Joining us right now from Beijing, Aaron Friedberg. He was from 03 to 05, Vice President Dick Cheney's Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs. He's currently Professor of Politics and International Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. He was in Singapore last week attending the big defense conference there attended by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Aaron Friedberg, thank you for joining us from Beijing.
Thanks for having me.
We have you, I guess, as representative of the so-called hardline in Washington. Why do you think Dick Cheney signed off on negotiating, or do you believe he did?
Well, I don't have any direct knowledge, and if I did, I wouldn't share it. But I assume that the administration agreed that this was the only way to continue to make progress on this issue.
Does it mean that the hardline path, and you define for us whatever that may have been or might be now, is finished, that the sticks have been downgraded and it's really the carrot path from now on?
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that. I'm not sure what the hardline position is in this or what it was. And I think what's relevant now is the fact that we seem to be closer to having agreement among certainly the permanent five members of the UN Security Council on the necessity of taking action to prevent this from happening. Now, we don't know how much agreement we have on that, but there's more of it. There seems to be a greater consensus on this than there was a year or 2 years ago, and that's, I think, what's critical.
Do you see it as a sign of American weakness or strength that now that they've reversed course on the negotiation openness?
Well, I don't know that it's entirely reversal of course. I mean, I don't think that anyone ever said we will never, ever, ever sit down and talk under any circumstances.
Haven't done it formally, openly in 27 years. That's a pretty long track record.
Well, of course, a lot of that time was not this administration. So it's been policy of the U.S. government because of the behavior of the Iranian government not to have formal diplomatic relations, although as a number of your other guests have pointed out, there have been negotiations between the U.S. and Iran over various issues over the years, including fairly recently. But I think that the what's critical, again, is the question of whether the context has been set now to increase the likelihood that negotiations could be successful. Just to have entered into negotiations without having lined up other parties, I think would have been fruitless. It may yet prove fruitless, but I think the time to do this has probably arrived, and the question is what the next steps are going to be.
Eyebrows are still pretty arched about the possibility of Russia and China going along with tough sanctions if and when it came to that. Do you think they would be here? Is the White House sort of setting the table for a coalition of the willing here if this big gang doesn't hold together?
Well, on the first part of that, the biggest question in my mind is what exactly, if anything, the Russians and the Chinese have agreed to. And that's unclear from the accounts that I've seen and the fact that the document itself listing the possible punishments and inducements hasn't been published makes it also a little bit difficult to determine. Frankly, I would be surprised if Russia and China had agreed to anything resembling sanctions at this point. And that's the biggest concern, I think, is whether they would stay with us. If now the Iranians say no, what are Russia and China and the European powers going to do? Or if the Iranians say yes, but, and try to separate us from our other negotiating partners, how tough are Russia and China willing to be? And there have to be, I think, major doubts about that because of their past behavior and also what seem to be their interests.
Or is it just a minuet? Alex is calling. Hi, Alex, you're on the air.
I have a question to the participants. There is a large minority in Iran, which is Azerbaijani minority, and I believe it comprises something of 30 or 40% of the population. And recently there have been reports that they feel unhappy. What the guests could tell about, is it a possible resistance to the current regime? Thank you very much. I'll take my answer.
You got it. Thank you. Vali Nasser, you've been watching this. Of course, there have been sort of, I don't know if uprisings is the right word, but unrest among a number of ethnic groups, Azeri, Kurdish, Baluchi. Is the U.S. hand in this? Does Iran believe the U.S. is active in fomenting this? How does this sit along with the invitation to negotiation?
Well, the Iranians definitely think, or at least that's their public comments, that the U.S. is involved. Even the Supreme Leader hinted on the Azerbaijani uprising that there were foreign hands involved. There are differences between these uprisings. The Kurdish and the Baluchi uprising is in areas which have been ethnically always a little tense. Azerbaijanis are very well, traditionally very well integrated into the Iranian society. There are some very high-ranking clerics in this regime that are Azerbaijani, and they live actually not only in the region of Azerbaijan, but also large populations in Tehran and even the city of Qom are Azerbaijani. But when earlier on we talked about security guarantees to Iran, this is definitely one of the things that the Iranians are very concerned about, namely as there are tensions brewing not only on the democratic front between the population and the government, but also along the ethnic front, that they would not be in some ways exploited. And that to them is part of the whole definition of security guarantees.
Do you see the U.S. hand in this unrest among ethnic groups in Iran? Is this a slow motion regime change stage setting here?
Well, there are some people in Washington among the so-called hardliners that you mentioned who have been writing about this sort of thing. It's difficult to tell, mainly because whether or not there is support for this sort of thing, not only from Iran, not only from the United States, but Iranians have also accused at times Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, particularly in supporting the Baluchi tensions, because it's led not by just an ethnic group, but by a Salafi group, which is very close to, in terms of its ideology, to Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda. But it's difficult to tell. But what matters is that the Iranian population has come because of the weights covered within Iran to believe that there is foreign hand involved. So at some point, whether or not is involved is becomes immaterial. Politically, the population feels that this is part of the larger confrontation with the West over the nuclear issue.
Aaron Friedberg, we've just got you for another minute from Beijing. What about it? Condoleezza Rice saying over the weekend that the U.S. government is now interested in the Iranian government's behavior, not its character, not the character of the regime. Are we walking away from regime change?
Well, I think the emphasis for a while has been on behavior, in particular on support for terrorism, and that isn't taken off the table by what she said. I think it probably is intended to signal primarily to the Europeans and our other negotiating partners that we're not intending to press for a change in regime. We're going to focus on their behavior. But given the behavior and how closely it seems to be interwoven with the character of the regime, it doesn't solve the problem.
Aaron Friedberg, former National Security Affairs Advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, joining us today from Beijing, China. Aaron, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Paul is calling from Dover, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. This is my question. How is it that the 20-ton woolly mammoth in the room is blending into the woodwork? The two words that I attach to that woolly mammoth are survival and trust. Iran or any other country, for that matter, in my eyes, is just simply trying to survive, and why should they trust us, especially, or anybody else in the world, why should they trust us with a policy of preemption, with flaunting Geneva Conventions, and, you know, some of the other policies that we have in this country? It is about survival and trust, and I just see that a lot of strategizing over this.
Yep.
This issue is leaving out the larger point at hand, which may be that a less threatening action and posturing on our part is the real answer. Maybe though not so sexy, a little more subtle, but where is that in this discussion?
Paul, we hear it. You're breaking up a little bit, but let me put it to Michael McFaul. Michael, Paul says the 20-ton woolly mammoth in the room is American action. And of course Iran wants nuclear weapons. How else can it ensure its own survival? Is it reasonable for Iran to stay on this path? Do you really think they'll get off of it?
Well, I think that does capture, in essence, the strategic thinking in Iran. I was talking to a senior Iranian official in Dubai about 6 months ago who used to be in charge of the nuclear weapons negotiations process. And, you know, after all of our pleasantries and talking for about 8 hours in the evening, it came down to this. He said, look, there were three countries that were singled out in the axis of evil. One didn't have nuclear weapons or a nuclear program, and they were invaded. So we want to have a deterrent so that that doesn't happen. Now, I think that is totally bogus way of thinking. I don't think that's in Iran's national security interest to think that way. But
why
that
not?
Was...
Why not? Explain why it wouldn't be. I mean, let's say Iran got the bomb. Doesn't that put them in a whole new situation? They don't have to worry about that invasion path.
Well, first, as Vali's already pointed out earlier, there is no plan to invade Iran that I know of. And I was just at the Pentagon last week.
Well, there wasn't a plan to invade Iraq for a long time either, and then there was, and then it happened.
No, no, no. It's apples and oranges. Let's be clear.
Okay.
It really is, especially today with as many troops as we have in Iraq. Iran is a country of 70 million people. It's a mountainous place. It's hard to get to. I just think any talk of military invasion is done by those that, you know, are trying to muddy the waters, not make them clear, including the Bush administration, by the way. I agree with the caller that we should stop talking about military action now and be less threatening. I agree with that. Where I think we have to be clear is that if you're for regime change, I'm for regime change in Iran, by the way. Mm. I'm with the Iranian people on that. I'm with those that think, you know, the Iranian people should have the right to elect their leaders in a free and fair election and not have some so-called supreme leader decide who's on the ballot. So I'm for that. The question is, I think, ironically, lessening the threat of military action would enhance the prospects of regime change in Iran. And here's the analogy I have. Think about Helsinki with the Soviets back 30 years ago. We signed these accords, and people forget, but when we assigned those accords with the Soviet Union, so-called Basket One was all about security guarantees, saying these are the borders that we are now going to recognize. Mm-hmm. Basket Three was about human rights. That's the one that everybody remembers. And I think a kind of similar deal with Iran, multilateral, bring them into a multilateral security organization, have the United States be a part of that, and then let's see, with this new approach, with more connectivity, with an embassy there and with American foreign investment there, does that help or hinder the prospects of democratization? I can't predict it, but I know that 25 years of doing nothing hasn't helped the cause at all.
But is there time for that now? I mean, the timetable is so obscure. We hear numbers all over the place, 3 years, 4 years, 5, 10, 15, until there might be a nuclear weapon. Is there time for the kind of soft approach you're describing?
Well, I would call my approach a grand radical approach. The problem, yeah, I agree that it's a race of time. But the problem with the approach we're taking now is it's an incremental step. The Iranians have all the time in the world, right? I mean, they're in no hurry to do anything. They'll sit
spin
on
it
this.
Out, stretch it out, and keep those centrifuges turning.
Yes, okay, yeah, exactly. And anybody who's Iranians in general, I would say, have a very different definition of time than we in the West do. And the Bush administration, because of their timetable, are the ones that are in a hurry. So I think, ironically, I mean, I want to say I really do applaud that we've done something, that Secretary Rice has taken this initiative. And by the way, I think it's a very risky one for her personally and her own reputation as Secretary of State. But it's not a grand one. And my worry is you're going to call me up in 2 years' time, mm-hmm. and you're going to call Vali, and we're going to have the same discussion, and we're not going to have advanced the ball in any way, shape, or form. Only Iran is going to be 2 years closer to having a nuclear weapon.
I guess that is the worry on many fronts. Vali Nasr, you've said that since maybe 2001 or so, the United States has, in fact, more strategic common ground with Iran than it does with Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, all of our nominative allies. Why? How?
Well, because in Afghanistan and in Iraq, essentially the strategic objectives that the United States had were those that Iran could support or benefited from, whereas those other countries which are our allies did not have anything to gain from what happened in Afghanistan and what happened in Iraq. Namely, the Pakistanis were the big losers from the invasion of Afghanistan. Iran was a big winner. In Iraq, Saudi Arabia and Jordan were big losers, and Iran was a big winner. And as a result, Iran potentially, even tacitly, could support those changes that occurred in the ground. However, the context of U.S.-Iran relations was such that they could not publicly have this common ground. But it remained that when the Taliban fell in Afghanistan, Iran and the United States could work very closely with each other at the Bonn Conference and have perfect agreement in putting the Karzai regime together in Kabul, which accounts for a large measure for its ability to stand up. And in fact, it's for that reason also that initially the Iranians and the United States thought that Iraq might be a place where discussions between the United States and Iran could begin, although that never actually happened.
So now the U.S. is over a huge barrel in Iraq. It's a very tough situation. Iran could make our life a lot worse there if it wanted to. What do you think is the way out of this? Do you think Condoleezza Rice has got it on track towards success? We heard how Michael McFaul would handle it. What do you think is the best path here?
No, I do think what Mike was saying makes a lot of sense, partly because one of the things you don't want to do in Iran if you want to support democracy is that you don't want to put democracy on a collision course with nationalism. And the people of Iran, whether they're liberal, democratic, theocratic, are going to band together if there is an outside threat to Iran. And that's going to harm democracy. And I think, you know, the more you create a scenario where the regime has to confront its own people rather than be able to bring them together, the better it is. But I also think that the broader the scope of contact on issues between Iran and the United States is, the more likely it is that the Iranians see benefit in talking to the U.S. and the U.S. will actually be able to push Iran in more directions than just on the nuclear issue. And I also think that this issue of the clock that we talk about, the clock is ticking a lot faster if we have a zero tolerance for any enrichment in Iran. In other words, Iranians are a lot closer to mastering enrichment, but they're not quite close to actually being able to build a bomb. The clock on that is much farther out.
Farther, and yet the ticking audible at this point, and the whole world paying a lot of attention. I'm so grateful to both of you for taking us through the undergrowth here. It's a fascinating game afoot. Vali Nasr at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, joining us today from New York. Vali, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Michael McFaul at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A big welcome today to old friends and new listeners at WSHA in Raleigh, North Carolina. Great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.